All right. What's going on? Kevin Cole here. Let me bring up the old comments. I'll post in here. Drop Q&A here. All right. Hopefully this is working. I see there's one viewer, so props to you first. That says zero viewers. Come on, guys. I know it's not the most convenient time, but we had a decent little crowd in here last time. As I mentioned on the Twitter bot, mostly I'm bored, so I'm going to do this. But I do think there are some things to talk about from some NFL news that happened this week. Maybe even go through a few draft scenarios, the rumor mill, the absurdity of draft season where everyone makes a billion predictions. They all get shared. They all conflict with each other. Most of them are overstated, or else like no one listens to what you have to say if you don't overstate it. Most don't happen. And then we just go on next year and do the same thing with the same people and for the same reasons. So if you have anything, any topics you'd like me to hit on, questions you'd like me to hit on other than what's normally, you know, throw it in the live stream, the comments here. Otherwise, I'm going to go to, let's just go to the Athletic homepage here and we'll try and figure out like what's going on in the NFL that I can talk about before we get into the draft stuff. Of course, we're going to have some draft stuff here. All right. So good. Okay. This is probably the number one thing that I want to talk about beforehand. And that is the Lions reset wide receiver O-line markets with extensions for Amon-Ra St. Brown and Penei Sewell. So that happened. I had a lukewarm-ish sort of take on this. Let me use a little bit more than lukewarm because it got some Lions fans upset. But, you know, Lions fans are going to get upset about everything. And, you know, Brad Holmes is a little bit on my radar for the fact that he's doing a little too much congratulatory back padding for how well they've done this year. So let me just say, when it comes to these extensions, period, if we're going to look at not just the Lions, not just these particular players, not just anything else, when it comes to extending your own players, it is better than spending the equivalent money in free agency. Now, part of that is just the pool that you have available to you in free agency is by definition those who have been not negotiated enough, have gotten enough of an offer to stay with their current team, didn't fit into the budgetary constraints of their current team. So they're probably not the most elite sort of players, especially at certain positions, tackle being one of them. So Penei Sewell, right tackle, is probably a little bit less valuable than a left tackle still, despite what people want to say. I know there's Lane Johnson, but outside of that, do we have a lot to really point to? Huge contracts for right-only tackles? No, we don't, really. So Sewell would be the next one there. So, you know, not that their positions aren't worth it, but you're just not going to find those guys in sort of free agency. So I'll give a little bit more credit to a tackle than probably even a wide receiver, because wide receiver is one of those things where you're probably not going to find the elite guys in free agency. But they have become available and become chips in trades recently. You still don't see that for tackles for the most part. I mean, we saw Laremy Tunsil get traded, but that was an absurd type of trade. You know, multiple first round picks and more going back. So a quarterback type compensation here. I'm not quite quarterback, but you know what I mean. Quarterback type compensation for a guy who at the time, I mean, Laremy Tunsil, I guess in some people's minds was a top tackle, but I don't think he had made a all-pro team or anything like that before he was traded. So it doesn't happen very often. You see guys later in their careers being traded. Offensive line has a longer time window as far as productive elite sort of play than you would find even for anything except for quarterback, probably. So the second contracts make a little bit more sense. They have a little bit more of a timeline there. So all that's good. But if we're talking about the contrast between reactions, whether it's reactions from the fan base, who, of course, we discount those. we discount all fan base reactions as either over-exuberation or copium or, you know, being overly critical in a lot of different ways. Even outside of that, if we see a lot of plaudits that are put forth for guys who are just re-signing and extending to big contracts. They say, great job by the Lions. Oh, the Lions are cooking. Oh, they're doing so well. I saw something just today about Howie Roseman where they're talking about the Eagles extension news maybe coming, and it's like, oh, they keep doing it. They keep doing so well. Okay, extending a player, choosing to make them the highest paid at their position, and of course the details come out, what does highest pay mean or not, who's going to subsequently sign, which will not make them highest paid. Yeah, regardless. But, you know, signing them to a contract that they'll take early too, so they're not, you don't get in a prolonged battle about what the contract needs to be, paying them off of extremely productive seasons too. So we're not exactly buying low on these guys, right? Doesn't say they're not worth it, but they've been extremely productive, and they're probably not at like their low point as far as their perception and value. Doing that is really the easiest thing that you can do as a GM. Extend, spend money, give them contracts where the cap hit is low up front. Every time you're signing a new contract, for the most part, unless it's a one-year deal we're talking about here, you are giving them upfront bonuses, signing bonuses, which are then going to be amortized over the life of the contract, which are going to drop the current cap hits. Again, you're doing it. You're doing the easy thing for next year, the all-in thing for next year. You're not getting bad headlines in the paper. You're getting praise from the fans. You're getting praise from the national media. You're not having to go through a hard negotiation with the player. You're not having to take a risk to say, if we trade this player and we get picks back, maybe those picks don't hit. Even if it's a strategically good move, you're taking in a lot more risk. You're going to get raked over the coals for it if it doesn't work. All those different things. So it isn't that extending players isn't correct, but it's really easy to do. Where GMs make their money, for me, probably not where they're actually making their money, because they don't follow what I'm saying most of the time, but where I differentiate between the great, sustainably, you know, franchises, sustainably run franchises, and those that aren't, are the ones who are willing to make the tough decisions to let players go. And when you do that, how you do that, how you choose to do that, what do you get back in advance? What's the timing on that? Are you doing it a year in advance, a year too early, or a year too late? All those things are very, very important. I mean, I think even when it comes to Stephon Diggs, for instance, and I wrote about this, but I'll talk about it here. That's a hard decision for the Bills to make, to trade him. And you could make the argument that this is the right timing because he started to have a decline, but it wasn't fully priced into, any notion of a decline was not fully priced into the trade compensation that you're getting for him. Being that the Texans are only, you know, are giving him a raise and just getting him for 1 year. Whereas if Diggs had a bad year this year, now in his early 30s, he would be pretty much worthless next year. So it's a year early versus a year late, all those sorts of situations. That's where you're making your money. That's where you're making a difference. That's the things that not everyone can do. Everyone can re-sign their own players as long as ownership, you know, there's ownership issues with certain teams, Indianapolis Colts, where they, you know, the owners are just cheap, Bengals. And you might not be able to do that all of the time, Raiders. So that can become an issue. But when we're talking about, you know, the Ford family over at in Detroit, yeah, they could probably throw the bag at some people. So they're going to throw the bag at Amon-Ra St. Brown, at Penny Sewell. Jared Goff, I guess, is the next person everyone's talking about is going to get something. They're handing out extensions to, you know, coaches, to GMs, to everyone else. That's great. That's fine. But it's not hard. It's not hard. It's not what differentiates you. Throwing the bag at everyone is not what differentiates you. And one question that I had specifically about Amon-Ra St. Brown. Okay. And I'll cop to the fact that it's a possibility that I'm wrong on this. Like, I don't think I'm 100, like, I'm not as certain on this take as I would be on other takes. But I do have a bias that used to be pretty hardwired into people's thinking in the past, which has now become less so as we've seen more and more production come out of the slot for the NFL. But that bias is to say, can this guy play outside? Is he meaningfully doing something on the field that's less replaceable than inside or short A dot sort of receiving work? So if we look at Amon-Ra St. Brown, okay, let's look at him. I'm going to go ahead, give a shout out to PFF here. Let's bring him up on the old PFF. So actually, can I make this fit the screen a little bit better? Okay, not really. So let's bring up his receiving here. So this is the thing that would trouble me maybe slightly. If you look at his seasonal stuff, go down to the bottom here. Hopefully my head's not blocking this. It's blocking some of it, but it's not blocking the stuff I want to highlight anyway. So let me make it even bigger. Okay, so if we go down to certain stats here, A dot I think is important. So if we go, it did extend the A dot. He's up to 8 yards this season for his A dot, but it was 7 his rookie season and 6.7 the year before there. 7.3 career A dot. So the yards per route run is really, really good. A dot, not so good. Now, your yards per route run for a receiver, it gets boosts, artificial boosts, whatever you want to say it. You should make adjustments for number one. If you're going out of the slot, you're going to get more yards per route run probably than the equivalent receiver out wide because it's just easier to get you the ball. So that's number one. Number two, I don't know how much they're doing 3 wide receiver sets for Detroit, but I would guess it's on the lower end, right? They're more of a running team. They're running more 2 tight ends. And if you look at, actually, you can see the numbers right on here. If you look at the slot percentages for Amon-Ra St. Brown, it was 77% as a rookie, 59% second year, 55% last year. So it's not like he's running 80% of his routes out of the slot. So calling him a slot receiver is more of a function of how he operates when he's running routes than necessarily where he's lining up. And the reason I say that is because if we go to, Tyreek Hill, okay? And people are going to call Tyreek Hill a slot receiver, right? But then if you look at last year, he was in the slot almost 40% of the time, over 40% of the time the year before, over 50%, 60% of the time in 2020. So the numbers actually aren't that different for how often he's in the slot. It's just they run 3 wide receiver sets in Kansas City. So they have like a dedicated slot guy most of the time. And he's running a different type of route tree, basically, when he's in the slot there. So if we look at overall, if we're going to go to positionally here, let's look at receiving, okay, for wide receivers. Let's take minimum targets of 100, okay, from last season. And if we scroll on over, actually, you can't scroll on this page. Come on, what's going on here, PFF? Okay, let me make it smaller so we can see. If we get to, eventually I'll get there. Oh, here we go, A dot. Actually, why can't I scroll, or can I? Oh, there we go. Whoops, I messed it up. Okay, so let's move it here. Let's get to A dot and focus back in. Okay, so if we get to A dot, and we say, let's look at all these receivers who had at least 100 targets. You have Mike Evans is number one at 15.1, like your classic outside receiver, although he ran 30% of his routes in the slot. So it's not just where you're running routes. Like these guys at high A dots, you still have Brandon Ayuk with 25% of his routes out of the slot. Chris Olave with 40% of his routes out of the slot. Yes, he's going down the field anymore. So I think maybe the slot receiver designation is a little bit off. It's more just like an underneath receiver is more the designation. So if you flip it around, the smallest A dots for any players, I'm including the postseason. Let's get rid of the postseason. The smallest A dot for any players, I'm not going to wait for this to pull up. Not great podcasting, I admit. Okay. The smallest, 5.2 yards for Rashee Rice And then next is Amon-Ra St. Brown. I mean, it is 8, so it's quite a bit higher than Rashee Rice. So he's not quite that bad. But it's the same as Adam Thielen. Okay? And then you have Michael Pittman, Zay Flowers, Ja'Marr Chase. Boy, poor Chase. 9.1 yards. And so on. So you get a lot of these guys, and then even guys who might seem as being like a slottish sort of wide receiver like Chris Godwin is still up at 10.3. So, yeah, I mean, Ja'Marr Chase is in here at 9.1 versus Amon-Ra St. Brown at 8.0. But I don't think anyone would say they're like equivalent type of receivers. And in fact, if you're going to go to Ja'Marr Chase and, you know, throughout his career, it's really just like he was 13.6 ADOT as a rookie, 9.9 in 22, and then down to 9.1. So, again, he profiles as someone who can do a little bit more than that. So I guess it's just like I still can't wrap my head around making the highest paid receiver in the NFL a slot receiver, basically an underneath receiver, because it is more replaceable. It goes into like the tight end valuation type of discussion too. And what I talked about before, when they're saying, oh, Brock Bowers is worth a ton because he's a big slot. Well, I mean, big slots aren't worth a lot in the draft. Slot receivers aren't worth a lot in the draft. Underneath receivers aren't worth a lot in the draft. There's a reason why Amon-Ra St. Brown was a fourth round pick. Now, obviously, he wouldn't go as a fourth round pick again if we knew who he was now, but he was. Cooper Kupp, there's a reason he was a third round pick. A lot of people point to Cooper Kupp as like, well, that's the example of why you do pay these guys. I mean, I don't know. Cooper Kupp's first extension was fine. I think it was 3 years, $48 million. Perfectly fine extension. Good deal. Type of deal that a highly productive underneath receiver, you give them that type of deal. You're not breaking the bank or anything like that for that type of deal. You're just like giving them a nice slot them in near the top. Now, what they ended up doing in LA, and not just with Kupp, but then also with Aaron Donald, also with Matthew Stafford, also with the GM and others, is after they won the Super Bowl, they just started throwing the bag at everyone. And obviously didn't turn out well for Donald. You know, he finally started to have some injuries and now he's retired. Hasn't turned out so hot for Stafford so far. And it hasn't turned out so hot for Cooper Kupp so far either, honestly, with the injuries. So again, throwing the bag at people, it's fine. Maybe they deserve it. It's Stan Kroenke's money over in LA. He's got enough. He's got more than enough for any human being to have. So it's fine. But I guess I'm just not going to throw plaudits at the Lions for, you know, right at this point. This is the hard point. This is the point where you got good combination of skill and luck to get to this point, to get a good team. Now, how do you maintain it? Not just to sign a bunch of contracts that'll have a low cap hit for the next 2 years and then explode in your face there beyond. And that's what I'd be a little bit concerned about. Okay, anything else going on in the world of the NFL? Let's see. Bengals, Trey Hendrickson trade request. That kind of goes into what I was saying before, where it was like the Bengals are cheap and not throwing the bag at anyone. I think teams get a little too much guff for being slow to re-sign players. I know people have been saying that about the Cowboys. Sure, how the Dak Prescott thing played out blew up in their face, but you know, there were a lot of people that were like, we don't know if you should even extend Dak Prescott at all. So them playing out the franchise tags there wasn't the worst thing humanly possible there. Other than that, what we got here? Drafty. That's kind of it, right? Okay, well, let's talk some draft scenarios, and then let me scan the Q&A now. If anyone wants to throw anything in there, see what we got here. Should we be willing to be mistaken because they have the ability to be successes once we don't try to be right, but instead adapt to changing circumstances? Sometimes the best player. I'm a little confused by that one. I think the best way is to actually embrace making a mistake as a valuable commodity. Okay, I don't know if I quite get that one either. Let's move on here. Okay. Is there any position group strong enough to draft you think would be worthwhile to move up for besides quarterback? Typically, don't love the value moving up, but mid-teen range cornerbacks are intriguing. Okay, well, let me say, first off, there's a great discussion on this as part of the Bet the Process podcast. If anyone listens to that, Jeff Ma, Rufus Peabody, Rufus has been on this program. I know Jeff. I kind of guilt tripped him accidentally. I didn't mean to hit him as hard as I did about the fact that we were at Sloan and he was looking over my shoulder the whole time we were talking to try to find someone more important. And ever since I was giving him shit about that, ever since that, that's all he talks about. That's all he talks about whenever I talk to him. But anyway, so on their podcast, they talked to Cade Massey. Cade Massey is one of the two authors of The Loser's Curse, which is the big study that talks about why you don't trade up, why there is basically a coin flip difference between the value of sequential picks at a position group in the draft, how the surplus value concept comes from them. They originally made it before the CBA was changed in 2011, which made it like criminal to take even any non-quarterback with the top pick, maybe even a quarterback with the top pick at that point, and why it was so much valuable to have lower picks and this and that. So anyway, check that out. There's a great discussion about this exact subject. I would still say that I don't think, at least theoretically, it should be possible to trade up for a non-quarterback and it be the correct move. Now, Cade, in this part of this podcast, there was a really interesting back and forth. And Jeff almost became like vocalized my thoughts, which was Cade was saying, you know, if you do it every now and again, and if you, for a particular reason or the right reasons, it can be acceptable, this and that. And what Jeff said, and which I agree with, you questioned back to him, he said, you know, you have a ton of evidence here that shows that it's not the right thing to do. And, you know, just opening up that possibility, just saying, oh, it's okay sometimes. Like, do you really believe that? Is that really the right way? Or if we're trying to be correct, we're trying to be right, shouldn't we just say, no, it's not really possible? And then Cade came back for the fact of, you know, there's truth and there's influence. What are you trying to maximize? I have to try to maximize not only the truth, but the influence and this and that. So what I'll say is, you know, theoretically that you could get some value in it, but I just think also if you think about it from like a game theory sort of theory prospect, there shouldn't ever be a situation where you can get value for the same reason that there shouldn't be steals in the NFL draft, because it's a liquid market, liquid enough. It's not, it's probably not liquid enough, but there's liquidity. Every team can trade up if they had a big enough trade, maybe at any time, other than if a quarterback or a player that they're totally sold on is going to be picked there. But you could, if a team's willing to trade to someone else, they should be willing to trade to you. I mean, if they're willing to trade to you, they should be willing to trade to someone else too, right? So there's liquidity in that pick. Anytime that you're going to trade up, that pick now is liquid. Like if a team's agreed to allow you to trade up into that pick, that's a liquid pick that someone else could be trading into. So you have that. The only circumstance where is if you had unique knowledge that was hidden, undiscoverable. I'm not sure if that's a word, but I'm going to use it. Fundamentally hidden knowledge that no one else has, proprietary knowledge that no one else has, and not bullshit knowledge, not like our scouts are the best. That's what most people think they have, you know, like something you can be actually confident in, not, oh, we developed this model that's really highly uncertain, but overfit. So we think it's very certain. And that's why this guy is better than everyone else thinks. Because as long as that pick is liquid, all the arguments you can make for it, you could say, oh, we're trading up for a premium position, so that's why it's worth it. Well, guess what? Everyone else knows what are premium positions and what aren't. At least there's someone else who knows that. Maybe not everyone, but someone else knows that. This is not unique knowledge, right? You could say, oh, there was a tier drop at this position, so we're getting the last player in that tier. Well, unless the entire rest of the NFL doesn't value a high positional value player in that tier, which probably a lot of people do, why do you think you're getting a discount that no one else could recognize? Again, these are things that everyone else recognizes. That's why I always push back against people when they say, well, this could be a good reason because of X, Y, and Z. It's like, well, everyone agrees on X, Y, and Z. So X, Y, and Z should be built into the price that you're paying if there's any liquidity. Maybe it won't be liquid sometimes. Maybe you can get away with that. But you at least have to think like that. You at least have to think and eliminate all the reasons why you're wrong that you're getting value here. First, eliminate all those reasons and assume all of those are correct. Assume as your baseline that people understand this tiering issue. Assume people understand, at least one other team, is willing to trade up, understands the positional value argument, then go through it again, and can we possibly be right? I still say no. I probably fall more on the Jeff Ma side of things, right? Would be like, no, you should never trade up. That was like the Trent Baalke question where he was like, oh, you know, they tell us never to trade up. Well, they're probably right. They tell you never to trade up. You got Trevor Lawrence. Now I understand for PR, for influence, for, you know, working with scouts, for making people feel empowered, all those sorts of things. You probably don't want to say that. You probably have no influence. And that's why I'm sitting here in, you know, not my mom's basement, but my own basement, making podcasts instead of running an NFL team. But that's just the way that I'm wired. I can't go and do the influence thing over the being correct thing. So no, that's the long answer to that question that I just went off on. But quarterbacks are interesting in the middle, like more late-ish first round, early second round. That's my next position, even before wide receivers, I think. You even want to prioritize them before wide receivers who you've had more, we've seen more success in the mid, late second round and in the third round, I think. Of course, it's all dependent upon the exact player, blah, blah, blah. Okay, Dr. Tough Guy. Question from Dr. Tough Guy. I'm team never trade up. Okay, I like that. You're on my team. As I feel even a QB one or two is a mystery box. Are QBs too scarce for that strategy? No, I think like theoretically you're correct on this, right? I think even this year is a little bit different because it seems like Caleb Williams is a tier above the other two. So if you had that number one pick, there might be a reason not to trade back. Even so, you're probably on average going to be correct if you did. Like, because everyone else knows that, right? Like, everyone else thinks Williams is pretty high, I guess. Unless the Commanders don't think that or the Patriots don't think that, right? Like, if there really were three top quarterbacks in this class and they're going to go one, two, three, and I don't know if there are. Maybe there are only two. If there really were three, you'd say, theoretically, you'd most often gain the most value and be correct if you said, I'll go back to three. I'll take whatever you're willing to give me, go back to three, and I'll take whatever quarterback is left at that point. It's probably actually going to be correct most of the time. Another interesting insight from this interview with Cade Massey, which I didn't know, is they actually did a study where, like, on average, even if you have perfect knowledge, I forget what he called it. It was like the Oracle's draft chart or something. If you had perfect knowledge, so after the fact, if you knew, let's say, which quarterback was going to be the best, which was going to be the second best, which was going to be the third best in this draft, more likely than not, even if you knew that, more likely than not, trading back from one to two, the trade compensation you're going to get for that is going to more than make up for the value that you lose. So it would be the right strategy to move back, even if you knew you were going from quarterback one to quarterback two, because we're probably overconfident in this draft of how much better Williams is than everyone else. So like in actuality, it ends up being more bunched up than you might think, even if you knew that. So that's really interesting. Quarterback, it probably applies less to than some others because just you have a volume expansion when it comes to, like, your production is higher, so the differentials are higher, so the trade value needs to be higher. So maybe it doesn't fully apply to quarterbacks. I would ask Cade about that specifically. But that's really, really interesting. So theoretically, yeah, you should probably always do that. Now, you could have been trading out of Trevor Lawrence to go to Zach Wilson, and then you're toast, though. So I do think the reputational damage and everything else, you know, it just depends. It depends. It's the whole thing of, in a way, it's analogous to when they talk about, I don't know if you guys have ever heard of long-term capital management. It was a hedge fund which blew up in the 90s or something like that. It was a bunch of quants who were running the hedge fund, and they had some sort of arbitrage strategy that they were doing. I think it was mostly bond markets and other things. I don't know the specifics. When Genius Failed, I think is the name of the book, because I read this book a very long time ago. But the point being, this is a little bit like when Genius Failed, long-term capital management, when we're talking about like trading out of a quarterback pick for a different quarterback pick. It is, you know, you're each time you do that, and you're not going to have many opportunities to do that, right? You're picking up value, but they call it like picking up quarters in front of a steamroller. So yeah, you like, if you know what you're doing, you can grab all those quarters and you'll have extra money in your pocket. If you don't know what you're doing though, the steamroller hits you. So the downside risk is quite high, especially reputationally and in the media and all that stuff, right? Like passing on one quarterback and going for the others. The downside risk is pretty high even on Caleb Williams, but the downside risk from a reputational standpoint, you might be able to survive that if it's like, it was the no-brainer pick to take them at number one. Okay. I also think moving up is almost always bad, if not a quarterback, but I'm okay moving up when it's outside the top 10 to 12 since the price gets way cheaper. Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, right? That's a good point. The prices are way cheaper in that point, but still, I don't know. It'd have to be really, really compelling just because teams have so many needs. Like, you have so many needs that locking in on a certain position, sometimes it can work and move up, sometimes not so great. Okay. How much of trading up is due to position scarcity? It's a good question. What I think is funny is one of the points that I think it was Seth Walder on ESPN came out with a kind of like a primer on what not to do when it came to trading up in the draft and things like that. And one of the things that he mentioned was, with all the talk that we have out there, well, he didn't mention this part, but this is me, my commentators. There's all this talk of like the draft guys, you know, the football guys, the best player available. Now they're saying that in like, don't account for positional value, which is dumb. But best player available should actually be kind of a thing within a tier of positional value. So if we're talking about you're in the middle of the first round of the draft or the first top half of the first round of the draft, if you have a quarterback, right, and there's no quarterback you want there, and you're staring at like tackles, edge rushers, pass rushing, interior defenders, you should go best player available between those most of the time. Tackle there's a little bit more assuredness there because their careers are longer. They play every snap, so you can't even rotate players. Like having a third great tackle, some diminishing returns on there in versus other positions where you can rotate players a little bit more and they have shorter careers. But even so, you know, guys get injured a lot. Guys are old. You can trade other guys. If you hit on a tackle, you can maybe trade one of your existing tackles and make a nice gain on that and have the rookie contract of your existing tackle. So people really should be doing best player available more often. But if you look at mock drafts, these same guys who believe the NFL is like smarter than nerds because they don't have, because they throw positional value out of the way sometimes, these same guys are like mocking exact position matches to teams over and over and over again. You know, everyone's mocking a tackle to the Titans. Everyone's mocking an edge rusher to the Falcons and so on. I mean, these teams that complete that they don't need players at other positions. I don't know. But so position scarcity would be part of it. But again, I would say, depending upon where you are in the draft, you should have at least three positions that are generally valuable in that range of the draft. So if you're telling me like your tiers are gone at all three of those positions, and then the tier that's available on the next way down in positional value is more valuable than anyone that's left, it's probably not the case. So, you know, draft away. Thoughts on teams taking an offensive tackle in the first round and playing them at guard with intention of kicking them out to tackle later? That's a good, actually, this kind of follows on to what I was talking about. Is this just sort of limiting the value you would get? No, I don't think, I mean, that actually fixes one of the things I was just thinking about. So Garrett Black here was like, he knew that he was going to pose this question, which would help answer what I was talking about, which is the fact that tackles can have difficulty getting that third tackle snaps because ideally an offensive tackle will play every single snap. You know, like Joe Thomas played every single snap as in his career. You don't take snaps off. There's no situational sort of issue there if you're healthy. They last a very, very long time. So yeah, no, I do like that idea. Like if you have a tackle here and you don't have anyone at edge rusher who you want there or an interior defender that you want there, you have, but you have that tackle. So you have two tackles, they're in different phases of their career. They're in different phases of their contracts, everything else. Yeah, if you took one and you decided for this next season, because we're already past like trade season, we're past everything else, that you wanted to use them as a guard, and that would be like a partial evaluation also for them, right? Like, you're not just going in naked at tackle in one spot and assuming that this tackle is, this rookie tackle is going to be good. Yeah, that sounds fine. It's tackle is, again, the longest lasting position outside of quarterback. So you may be losing some of that surplus value in year one, but guess what? Guards cost a lot now in free agent markets. They're a good position to tackle in free to tackle. Now I'm confusing my words. They're a good position to go after in free agency, but they ain't cheap either. Okay. The NFL teams determine what the market for player is. So while we are on the outside might think a selection is a steal, in reality, X number of teams would argue otherwise. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's what people don't understand about a lot of these things is that, like, you're not bidding against the team with the pick, or when you're trying to trade for a player on that roster, you're not like bidding that much against that team. You're not in a room, just the two of you hashing out, well, we think the player is worth X and you think the player is worth Y. Let's come to an agreement. The reality is you're bidding against other bids, right? That's the leverage that a team has when they're going to trade out of a pick, is they, or implicit or explicit leverage that they have is that someone else will trade into this. That's why I always think it's silly when we have these discussions of, oh, this team is pretending to be interested in a quarterback at the top of the draft so that they can raise the value on the pick before they trade it. Like, no one should believe that. No one should believe a team willing to trade out of a pick is really interested in a quarterback. And this comes a little bit. Maybe I'll just, as a side note here, I'll discuss the Patriots here. I don't know, man. If the Patriots have that much interest in potentially trading out, if they're talking about it that much, unless they're just really waiting on seeing who's going to be available at three, that means they're probably going to do it. They're probably going to trade out. I don't buy the, oh, we're going to entertain a ton of different offers. And if we get, you know, one extra second round pick in the future from this team, that we're going to trade out of a quarterback who we like. And if we don't, we're going to draft them. Nah, I don't think that's how things work. It's not how things work. There's no like tipping point like that, that would comport with what teams are willing to pay. Now if they threw in an extra like two first round picks, yeah, now we're talking, but I don't think anyone's doing that. So the Patriots thing is interesting. Or I've seen, and this is like one of these accounts that I was making fun of, this Pretty Ricky account that I was making fun of the fact that they're all bullshit, but who knows? Maybe he knows something. But his theory was, what he knows, because he's an insider. He's an anonymous insider, is that they're either looking at JJ McCarthy or trading out. That makes more sense to me, honestly, than them being interested in May or Daniels, because they wouldn't be having all these trade discussions if they were interested in May, because they're probably going to, or not they wouldn't be having them, but it'd be very preliminary. We wouldn't be hearing so much about it. It'd be more like if May went to, then they could find someone to trade for Daniels. But it doesn't seem like May is going to go too. It seems like Daniels is going to go too. So if they were really into May, I don't think they'd be wasting their time with all this trade talk. So maybe they're actually into McCarthy. That's possible. Now, that could be a reason why they would want to go down, probably not to 11, but somewhere else. So anyway, yeah, like, it's one of those things where the market value is determined by who else is willing to trade into it, not the discussion. So again, the market value for any trading up in any tier, everything else, it's all based upon what other teams are thinking at that point in time. To be frank, sometimes teams don't seem to know what they are doing. Yeah, no, that's definitely true. But again, that's when it comes down to reaches. Teams that reach don't know what they're doing, because you only need one team to not know what it's doing to reach for a player. You only need one team to trade up and give up way too much, right? Because they can't judge the market, or they're just dumb and they don't realize that they're overpaying, and the team that they're buying from isn't going to be like, hey, you know, you're giving up way too much for this pick. They'll say, thank you, sir. Whereas if you're trading away the pick, it's harder to be dumb, because unless you just make the trade without exploring any other offers, you know, like when teams are always like, oh, this team got fleeced. who traded away this player or traded away this pick. I mean, there are situations like during the life cycle of the year where players are more or less expensive and maybe you want to maximize that, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, teams are mostly just trading away to whoever's going to pay the most, whoever's going to give them the most compensation outside of their division, maybe. So it's harder to get fleeced when you're trading away a player or trading away a pick because there are you can check in on multiple offers. It's easier to get fleeced if you're trading for a pick or you're trading for a player because you don't know. The market is cloudy at that point unless you're calling around to your buddies and you guys are have collusion. But I don't think any of that's going on. How do you think teams decide on fair draft compensation in a trade? Why don't we see, I'm editorializing here, not editorializing, but I'm adding in here. We see more rebuilding teams prioritize next year picks on suspect teams taking suspect picks. Well, okay. So you're talking about suspect teams, suspect picks, I assume, because we're talking about like, you're getting a second round pick, but you get like almost a first round pick instead of a second round pick. So that really only applies to the first and the second round, you know, the third round, whether you're drafting at 75 or 95. I mean, it makes a difference, but it's not nearly as big of a difference as maybe a 20 pick differential within those rounds. Number two is like the suspect team has to be willing to trade with you for that pick. But yeah, I think you should be seeing this more often again, but teams get locked in on the player that they want. They're in, like, we should be seeing tons more trades during the draft. You know, theoretically, there should be tons of teams willing to move up or down slightly based upon their preferences, based upon their team building, based upon their windows, based upon everything else. But a lot of times they just have a board and they love that number one player on their board and they almost love the number two player just as much. And they love that number three player. Let's remember, these guys have boards, and the Giants, they came out with a story about Joe Shane, I think you pronounce his name, even though it doesn't look like that. Joe Shane there, you know, from the Bills, who's there, who said they had 15 players with first round grades this year and they only had 11 last year. I mean, of course it's absurd. You know, of course they found one of their 11 players at 24 last year. But when you have these 11 players who you love, these guys, oh man, the love is like, it's unquantifiable. Even as a nerd, I could not quantify the love between a GM and a scout and their top prospects. So they love these guys so much. So you have these 11 guys who you love more than your family, more than anyone else in the world. And one of them falls to you, not even falls to you, because sometimes like the 11 who you like includes guys who are like consensus big board 30, but you think they're the 11th best. So when that player is available to you at your pick, and now you're going to have to, even if a team that's suspect, like a team that might fall off a cliff next year, wants to trade into that pick, these guys don't want to, they love their guys too much. They love they're like, oh my God, there's only one or two of my 11 guys who I love more than my own family left. I can't trade back out of this. And that's when it becomes the problem. It's the lack of like, it's how like anchored they are to making one of these picks. And that's when it becomes a problem. But related to this, suspect teams making suspect picks, the best scenario of this is why trading out of a quarterback pick can also be good. And again, we're talking about like, even if you need a quarterback, like trading back and getting a quarterback who's a little bit later, if you're willing to take that risk, and now most of us don't have job security like that, like you kind of have to be the owner and the GM there. Another reason why that's good is teams that trade into a quarterback, hey, there's probably like a 50% chance they're just bad or not good, below average. There's a 25% chance they're god-awful. And the team is like drafting near the top of the draft again. So you got that pick now at the top of the draft. And then there's a 25% chance they're pretty good, you know, and you didn't make a huge return on that pick. But that's why it's good to trade out of quarterback trades, because you're just throwing a rookie quarterback into the mix, which could end up being god awful. So because they could end up being god awful, they'll be like the worst quarterback in the league. And that'll have such a negative effect on that team. And, you know, quarterbacks are normally not bad as rookies, but they're not as good. Like their second year performance is much more indicative of who they will be going forward than their first year performance. First year performance matters, but it's on like the range of outcomes in your rookie year are just lower. It's like shift the whole thing lower. Like you get a Justin Herbert type of season, it's just an incredibly awesome rookie season, and you're like, oh, you're the, you know, 10th best quarterback in the NFL, the 8th best quarterback in the NFL, like CJ Stroud last year. You're not first in the NFL, even an extraordinarily good season. So that's, again, trading out of quarterback picks, theoretically good. In practice, maybe not as good. All right. We know this is a Q&A here from Intellect Sports. I like that. It's good. It's good branding there. We know positional value is an absolute first. How do you maybe view, I don't know, again, I'm adding stuff here. Player capabilities when drafting a player. Example, if a team needs a good run stopper, okay, well, I'll just stop you right there. We don't need a good run stopper. But anyway, we want to invite the run. They look at the best run stopper available at the pick. Yeah, I mean, I think you have to say, like, where can we get a good run stopper and have this mapped out before the offseason even happens and probably address that in free agency or something like that. So you're not really even tempted to draft one. It's a weird thing with the NFL where you have, not weird, but it's different than the NBA. Because the NBA is extremely weird because the draft is, can you imagine if the draft was like it was in the NBA draft where, I mean, you saw this with the WNBA too, right? With Caitlin Clark, where it's like you're playing the finals one week and then the next week you have the draft. Now you got this long like playoffs that come with it. Like we have all this time to overthink everything in the NFL. And we have free agency first and then the draft, which is kind of weird because like a lot of free agents end up becoming superfluous after you've drafted players potentially to fall in there. So if you're going to want a run stopper or someone like that, someone you're afraid you might spend too much value on or be too tempted to take in the draft, you know what you do? You get those guys in free agency or with a cheap trade or with a pick swap or something like that. Bring them onto your roster. Take that, like, unburden yourself. Okay, that's a big thing of these things here. Structurally, I don't even trust myself in these situations that I would do things correctly. So you have to try to have incentives and structures to point you in the right direction. And one of them would be fill those positions first. I didn't know about Joe Thomas, never missed a snap. That's impressive. Yeah, he did miss in his final season, but before that, it was like he never missed a snap for like 10 years or something like that. It was ridiculous. Can we start a campaign to get rid of all the cheap owners in the NFL? Well, they're trying. They're trying, if you haven't noticed. Like, I don't think it hurts that, well, Dan Snyder was rich, so maybe that didn't matter. But, like, if you look at the dudes they're bringing in now, when it comes to, like, the Teppers of the world, who's the other one? The Broncos, the Waltons, you know, they're getting Walmart money there. All that sort of stuff is coming in. Like, all the owners who have come in, and this has been a longstanding thing, probably going back to, like, I don't even know how far you have to go back. I mean, even, like, Robert Kraft coming in and taking over the Patriots, Jeff Lurie coming in and taking over the Eagles. A bunch of money has come in. And now they're getting bigger and bigger. I mean, we're talking about guys who are coming in now and becoming owners. You know, Bezos was being talked about. It's almost like you have to be in the $5 billion or higher club in net worth in order to get in there. And I think we're seeing a market effect on how this is affecting contracts, which is more upfront money, more ability to take dead money, which is adding more liquidity to trade markets and other things. I mean, think about it. We had Carson Wentz was like doubling the most dead money ever when his dead money was, I don't even remember what it was, 20, 30 million when he was traded from the Eagles. And now we got Russell Wilson where we're at like 80 million or something like that, or like that. And again, you had the new owners there who, you know, the couldn't care less about dead money and sunk costs and that sort of nature. So I think we're going to continue to see it move in that direction. So we'll see how long these guys can hold on. Now, ownership can also hold on longer in the NFL because it's a money printing fest. There's no like local TV ups and downs that happen and the revenues ups and downs. Sure, the Cowboys make more money than everyone else because they have higher ticket prices, because they sell more merch, because of all that stuff. But still, the big share of revenues that everyone's getting is from the national TV contract. So whether you stink or not, you're getting the same share of that. And that keeps your Mark Davises of the world, your Jim Irseys of the world, it keeps them in the seat no matter how incompetent. I don't know the guys. Maybe they're not incompetent, but they don't look that competent to me. How incompetent they are, how poorly the teams perform, so on and so forth. The checks just keep on coming in. All right. I think I got through everything here as far as questions, about 50 minutes. That sounds pretty good. Enjoy the draft tonight. I may live stream later. I got a soccer tryout slash practice to attend with my son. So I'm actually going to miss the beginning of the draft. I'm probably not going to get back until like 8:30. How long does it last? Is it 9 o'clock? Does it last till? So maybe I'll jump on here and do something afterwards. Otherwise, I'll talk with Benjamin Robinson tomorrow because he's grinding the mocks. He has all the data. We can figure out what the quantifiable biggest surprises and reaches and steals and all that stuff is tomorrow. 8 to 11. Oh, Jesus Lord, that's late. I'm a East Coast guy who dies on this sort of stuff. So anyway, I'm also saying someone put that in the comments that it was 8 to 11. Okay, so anyway, I'll check in with you guys tomorrow no matter what. And I'm going to have the pieces out on the site where I use positional value, stealer reach, trade value gained. I have estimates for all of those for any picks that are traded for any positions in any range. I have estimates for all those on a dollar basis, which you can aggregate up, and then I give kind of my grading based upon that, and I can figure that out for the first round. Oh, all right, one more for question here. How do you value positional value versus quality of player? For example, the 2022 Ravens drafted a safety and center. Does them becoming elite outvalue drafting a position of value? I mean, probably not. I mean, you know, hat tip to them that they definitely didn't reach for those players versus big board consensus and things like that. But I think it's hard from a team building perspective, even if you're hitting on those players, because if you're using that mid first round pick on first round picks on safeties and centers, then yeah, you got those boxes checked with elite players, which is helpful. But if you could have checked those boxes in free agency at a much higher cost with decent players, then you could have checked the box potentially for an elite player at a more valuable position, or even a good player at a more valuable position where it's very, very tough to find them in free agency. So like in the short term, it works pretty well because you're getting those elite players on a rookie contract immediately. In the longer term, as players start to age out, as your edge rushers leave, as you got to figure out how to fill that, how to fill tackle, how to fill harder positions, wide receiver, cornerback, it becomes an issue. Then it becomes a little bit of an issue from team building. That's the problem. Not that the individual players at an elite level are not good, but when you look at it as a whole pie or a portfolio that you're trying to fill in of team building, it becomes more complicated. Anyway, all right. I'll check you guys all out tomorrow if you're listening in. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you then.